Do you know what time it is? It's supernatural story time. And if you're easily scared, and even if you're not, there's only one thing left to do. Just turn off the lights, because these are stories that you listen to only in the dark. What goes bump in my room? I was 14 years old, and this was the first time I had my own room. And the room was the same size as our master bedroom. Large enough for a queen-size bed and one of those old double desks. Solid mahogany desk from the 1920s like detective partners used to use. As a matter of fact, it was a hand-me-down from my grandpa's office as a police commissioner in a small Arizona town. It had seen its fair share of wear and tear, but it was my favorite part of my room. I had my old TV and my N64 set up on the desk. I couldn't play while sitting on my bed because the TV was too small. So I'd sit on my desk and play Banjo-Kazooie. The point is that I loved this room. It was big and it was mine, to myself. I hadn't been in the room that long when things started to get weird. At first, it was just mild cases of sleep paralysis, waking up feeling like something was holding me down, and still seeing figures from my dreams. But I always knew that it was just dreams. They were just something completely unreal about the experience, though. Soon, however, I started to experience worse and worse phenomena. Strange sounds from my closet, the door securely latched moments prior, opening halfway, things that a very logically oriented mind like my own would dismiss as just weird happenstances. The AC pushed the door open, one of my pair of jeans fell on the hanger, those kinds of assumptions to avoid getting out of bed and investigating. After spending the better part of a year simply ignoring all of the things that went bump in my room, I had an experience that I will never forget. I had fallen soundlessly asleep, like I would any other night, no feelings of dread foreshadowing the events to unfold. It was just a normal hot night in the dry desert city in a little town in Arizona. Unsurprisingly, I woke up sweaty. The surprising part, no, it wasn't that it was only 3 a.m, or that it was precisely 3 a.m, like I literally watched the clock change from 2:59 to 3 a.m. as I woke. It wasn't even that the sweat that drenched my body in sheets was cold, as if it had been ice water seeping from my pores. No, the surprising part of this sudden awareness I had was the light. Since I was an infant, I could only sleep in absolute darkness, so I know I didn't leave any lights on, nor could I have owned anything that produced the light that now filled my room. Indeed, there is not any sort of invention of man that can produce the kind of light that seemed to be consuming my room. Blue, purple, white, and every other cool color that fills the sky on the most beautiful day seemed to emanate from nothing and everything at the same time, luminescent, glowing with a cool brilliance that washed over every nook and cranny of my room, leaving nothing in shadow. Yet with this light there was no warmth, no comfort, only an overwhelming sense of despair, like a block of ice had found its way into the valves of my heart and was stuck there, slowly freezing the beating of my heart. And then it was there, sitting on my desk directly across from my bed, its knees together and ankles crossed. It sat in a very feminine way, though it would be hard to say this was a woman. Ambiguous in its sexual features, it was still the most perfect and beautiful creature I had ever seen. Imagine the perfect woman slash man, if you will, the one with a perfect face, hair that is soft and straight, eyes that are piercing and a smolder that is impossible to resist. That image you just pictured pales in comparison 100-fold. This being was beyond words. I can only do my best with the English language, and it will never do it justice. Silver, gold, platinum, and every color of precious metal was in every strand of its hair that cascaded down the sides of its flawless ivory face, like a thousand strands of silk. Its face looked truly chiseled from the purest ivory, but looked as though it was as soft as flower petals. It was the most beautiful face I had ever seen, with eyes of a color that no language on earth has a word for, and deep enough that you felt as though you were staring into an expanse so massive that your very soul would fall through if you stared long enough. It would be the most exhilarating experience of my life, and not for the deep-rooted fear, the screaming of my soul to turn away, to run, to do anything to rid myself of this entity. Regardless of my fears, I was rooted to my bed, as if there was some force keeping me there, sitting motionless, waiting for whatever this creature had in its mind to do with me. It felt an eternity, but in the blink of an eye, the entity was sitting straddled across my legs, its face tilted slightly to one side as if to study my reaction. Silken strands of liquid metal hair fell across its perfectly formed lips as it moved. Its lips were soft as velvet and pink. I remember the color almost looking red in contrast with its pure white skin. Through my fear, I wanted to love this being, for it was beyond words, beyond emotion, beyond our feeble-minded attempts to comprehend. But the fear that gripped my heart, like my blood had been replaced by ice water, filled my being so completely there was no room for any other emotion or thought. Again, an eternity passed as this thing stared at me with eyes like holes in reality. Suddenly, that reality changed drastically. What was once white, soft, and smooth became ashen, dead, and peeled, and flaked. Its skin withered like cottonwood tree bark, curling in on itself and peeling away. The metal of its hair tarnished, rusted, and lost all color, drying and becoming brittle as if it were made of old, dry cobwebs. It fell in chunks from the entity's head, carrying bits of scalp with it. Bone showed through here and there where the skin peeled away, and I could see the bone twisting and deforming. Knobs of gnarled bone protruded from its skin through the flesh of its face and scalp. When it finally chose to speak to me, the corner of its mouth split open, the skin tearing more and more the wider the mouth grew. Strings and tendrils of flesh still connected the jaw where the cheeks once were. Beneath, I saw teeth, rotted, deformed, and too many, jagged and crooked. Its mouth open, a gray pink tongue, fell from where once lips sat perfectly. It boiled and writhed, growing far too long for its own mouth and covering itself in yellow-green pustules. Hot air wafted across my face and nostrils. It is a scent that I will never forget. It was as if someone rolled in the hot entrails of a fresh-killed carcass and tried to mask their stench with a floral perfume. And then it spoke. There were words and phrases and sounds forming syllables and sentences, but it was not in any language I had ever heard or have heard since. It spoke to me of things that I no longer remember, things that I should never have known and have forced myself to forget. I tried to scream, to cry out for deliverance from this torment, but the words turned to ash in my mouth. I could only choke silently as the scent of it mingled with the soot clinging to my tongue and throat. With my heart, I cried out to God. I begged him to deliver me from this creature, and my voice returned, if only just enough to mutter the name Jesus. The moment the final syllable of that beautiful name passed my lips, my room was in total, utter darkness. There was no presence in my room. I was alone. But there was no peace in my heart. Fear still had a grip on my heart and mind, and I wasted no more time flinging myself into the bathroom and filling the tub with water. I dropped the wooden cross I always wore into the water and prayed to God that the water would act as my shield. In my pajamas, I spent the next 5 or 6 hours in that tub, quietly muttering any prayer I knew, crying tears that tasted of ash. This was my first and most horrifying experience with this entity, and the first time in my life that I ever experienced a preternatural or paranormal. It would not be the last, nor would it be the only creature I would encounter. But that is for another time. Silhouette of Evil. When I was a child, I was taught that demons were a metaphor for our sins and that they were boogeymen, told to Christians to get them to say their prayers. It took the worst years of my life to learn the truth. I was confronted by a demon when I was younger, and for years I believed this was merely a bad dream. High school stress and puberty can do that to you, right? After repeated visitations, I sought help. Priests, rabbi, even a Taoist monk. I sought the help of a reputable mystic, psychic, in one last desperate attempt to understand what was happening with me. Dr. Rosen took great interest in my condition and helped me to come to terms with my gift at seeing the unseen. He gave me some charms and chants, and for a time the entity left me alone. Completely amazed at his work, I took to apprenticing under him. Life seemed to make sense for a time. There came a day when he trusted me to accompany him on a paranormal investigation into a purported haunted house. I remember walking up to the house, my palms sweaty, my heart racing, but I wasn't scared. No, I was excited. I couldn't wait to meet whatever spirit was haunting this abode. I look back now at how naive I was with a certain forlorn nostalgia, wishing I could have stayed forever that optimistic. With age, however, comes wisdom, and with wisdom comes cynicism. As we approached the house, the little old lady who called this place her home rushed out to meet us politely, showed us to the most haunted areas of the house, and then retired to her bedroom to sleep. Dr. Rosen decided to turn off the lights in the house and asked the spirits to turn them on in proof that they were there. Of course, just like any cheesy paranormal movie, the spirits complied. He then switched on the EMF receiver and the white noise recorder. He asked a few more questions and documented every little thing we heard or saw happen. Considering that it wasn't much, it was still very exciting. After an hour or so of this, Dr. Rosen told me to ask some questions and try to keep the spirits active while he listened to the white noise recording. I gladly accepted and thought of a good question to ask. This was an unknown spirit or spirits. There were so many questions I had, so many things about them I wanted to know. Who are you and why haven't you crossed over? That seemed like as good a question as any, just as I spoke the words, "Who are you?" Dr. Rosen looked up at me with wide eyes and skin as white as a virgin's wedding gown. "No," he whispered. The house shook violently as soon as the words left my mouth. Lights flickered and flashed until bulbs shattered. A deep growl emanated from the walls, even as Dr. Rosen and I cowered in terror. Then all was still and the house was black as ink. There was movement to my left where the doctor had been when the lights were on, and a muffled whimper. It struck me then that he had never experienced this sort of reaction before. Lightning flashed, and there in the archway between the kitchen and the living room was a silhouette. I would like to say it was a silhouette of a man, but this thing was inhuman. It stood taller than any man I had met and broader by far. It barely fit the archway. It was there for a fraction of a moment before lightning struck again and the creature had vanished. A light flickered onto my left and I realized Dr. Rosen had a flashlight in his hand. He was shining it at the entry to the kitchen, shaking like a leaf. I started but trailed off. As to my great relief, the little old lady was standing where the silhouette had been. The dark must have been playing tricks. "Mrs. Habersham," I started, "did you feel the shaking and hear whatever that was?" She just stood there, a confused look on her face. No, confusion isn't the right word. Honestly, she looked as though she'd had a stroke. I took a step toward her, but Dr. Rosen stopped me. "What?" His answer was little more than a whisper, but I will never forget the words. "It wants you." If I forget those words, surely I'll always remember the fear that gripped me, like ice in the warm torrent of fluid that covered my left side only moments later. The flashlight hit the floor and I scooped it up and pointed it toward Dr. Rosen. In his place there stood a large ashen creature, human in appearance aside from the lack of face. The head of the thing tilted to the side and the light began to flicker just before the light died away. I could see the creature pulling Dr. Rosen's head over top of his own. If I hadn't been too nervous to eat all day beforehand, I'm sure I would have shit my pants, quite literally. I flung myself through the house and toward Mrs. Habersham and the front door. I could feel the footsteps behind me, almost like hoofbeats. It was taking its time, savoring the stench of fear. "Why are you doing this?" I demanded to know. Dr. Rosen, or the creature that was wearing his flesh, didn't answer. The little old lady, however, did. "We want to fuck your corpse," she screeched at me. I flung her away. When her body slammed into the ground, I could hear bones snapping, the sickening thud of her skull on the hard floor tile. I don't remember now. As I reached out to help her, her head righted itself and she gave me a sickening grin, mouth full of blood. I caught Dr. Rosen in the corner of my eye and moved for the door again. It was to my left, just out of reach. I was going to make it. My fingers brushed against the brass knob. It turned. The latch clicked and the door swung open. I took my first step to freedom. The feeling of relief, although incredible, was very short-lived. Hope crashed around me as my foot refused to cross the threshold. Something had a hold of it. some sort of rope. I felt a sharp tug in my foot went out from under me. They dragged me back into the house and the door slammed shut. No, it can't end this way. I pulled out a small pocket knife I carried on me. More a box opener and utility blade than an actual knife. The blade stood at about 2 inches and some change, but I grabbed the rope and started to saw away at it. It wasn't a rope. It was slimy and elastic, almost like a tentacle. The blade struggled with a tendril, whatever it was, as Mrs. Habersham and Dr. Rosen started dragging me toward the basement door. I sawed vigorously. The blade finally found purchase along the slimy, slick exterior of my bindings, and the snick of a blade through flesh made me shiver. Then came the smell, a smell like death and excrement, the same smell you get when you cut too deep cleaning an animal, the very same smell of entrails spilling their contents of filth. My eyes shot up to Mrs. Habersham, her hands grasping the other end of the rope, which seemed to be coming out of her stomach. I hacked at the intestines, holding my leg while I fought the urge to vomit. Just as the duo reached the door and opened it, I felt the entrails tear and Mrs. Habersham fell forward as all the tension was released. I bolted around the corner of the hallway to come face to face with the stairs going up. I knew there was no exit on the second floor, but I had to get away from them before I could think about escaping. I scaled the steps three at a time. By the time I reached the top, I could hear Dr. Rosen thumping up from the bottom. I threw myself at the nearest bedroom door and slammed the door shut behind me. I fumbled for a half a second with the knob, finding no lock before I shoved the dresser in the way. It moved too easy. A lightweight particle board dresser, most likely from IKEA, was the only thing standing between me and those things out there. I readied my pocket knife like I had seen in the movies. I needed a better weapon. As I turned away from the door to look for anything better than a pocket knife, there was a knock at the door, gentle almost followed by the soft, caring voice of Mrs. Habersham. "Young man, stop this foolishness and come out here. We only intend to flay your flesh from your bone, one layer at a time, until we reach your juicy innards. Doubt, worry, though, will give you the first bite." A fist pounded at the door and I could hear the knuckles break. "Oh, dagnabbit," I heard her shout. "I chipped a nail." The second fist cracked the cheap wooden door, and the third came right through, a mangled mass of flesh that used to be an old woman's hand, pushed through the hole. "Look at what you made me do." Not one to stand idly by while lunatics were outside my door trying to kill me, I had found a makeshift weapon in the form of a paper cutter blade. This must have been a craft room before Mrs. Habersham turned into a demonic vessel. I grabbed her mangled hand with my left and brought the blade down on her arm, just behind the wrist. I'm not sure what I expected to happen, but the blade, not nearly sharp enough, merely cut her to the bone and stopped. "Really?" I heard her mutter from behind the door. I wrenched the weapon free and brought it down hard again. This time the force of the blow was enough to break the bone. I hacked one more time and pulled with all my strength, tearing the last skin away. I felt a moment of victory before Dr. Rosen threw himself against the door. This time the wooden dresser splintered and cracked. Two or three more and he would be through. My heart was racing. I knew this weapon wasn't going to save me. I was alone and these demons were going to do terrible things to me. "Why?" I cried out to no one and everyone. "Because you look fucking delicious," one of them shouted through the door. Thump! The wood cracked and the dresser moved a foot out of the way. A long, spindly arm reached in and felt round the wall before retreating. Thump! The dresser fell to its face and the door swung open wide. Dr. Rosen stood, his face twisted into the last moments he experienced in his life. I threw myself at the man I once called a friend. When my shoulder connected with his sternum, he toppled backward, tripping over the much shorter Mrs. Habersham. As they both tried to stand at once, they tangled their broken limbs together. I brought the blade over my head and swung hard. Dr. Rosen's skull cracked under the blow. He started laughing hysterically. Another blow to his head and his eyes popped from its socket, just dangling there. His laughter continued even more twisted. I brought the blade sideways directly under his chin, smashing his voice box and taking much of his throat with it. "Shut up!" I screamed as I hacked and hacked at my friend's corpse. I knew I wasn't hurting the puppeteer, but what was I supposed to do to these things? His laughter became a gurgled mess of blood, but didn't slow down a notch. "Jesus, make him stop!" I screamed. A light, bright and hot, flashed from inside of Dr. Rosen, and I was flung like a rag doll back into the room I tried to hide in. I couldn't tell what had happened. It was like a flash bang went off in my head. All of my senses were ringing and my skin felt like it was on fire. I tried to scream, but there was no sound from my throat. All I could hear was the voice of a frantic Mrs. Habersham in utter terror. "No, no, no!" she screamed at something. "He's ours! You can't do—" Her voice was replaced by what I can only describe as the sound of a giant water balloon popping, filling the hallway with her innards. The sound made me cringe, and as the whiteness slowly faded into colors and shapes, I could see the horror of what became of Mrs. Habersham and Dr. Rosen. From the chest up, excluding his arms, Dr. Rosen had been burnt away. The edges of his wound still smoldered, as did the carpet beneath the gaping hole where his face and chest used to be. Mrs. Habersham was spread over the entire hallway, floors, walls, ceilings, like she had been filled with too much blood, and she popped from the pressure. Once I'd wiped the vomit from my mouth, I scanned the house for any sign of my savior. There was no one there but me. I retrieved Dr. Rosen's keys from his pocket, got in his truck, and drove. When the tank ran out of gas, I walked to the nearest motel and tried to wash off the filth and perhaps scrub away the memory of what had just happened. Getting out of the shower, I noticed a mark on my skin that wouldn't wash off. It was right in the middle of my forehead, a five-pointed star within a seven-pointed star within a circle surrounded by letters I didn't recognize. I tried asking around if anyone had seen anything like it, but no one could even see it. I tried to take pictures of it, but it seemed even the camera couldn't see it. Eventually, I gave up and figured I was just experiencing PTSD. That was until I got a note sealed with wax, stamped in the exact shape of my mark. The note asked for my presence, gave an address in the UK, and promised answers. I immediately bought a ticket to Glasgow International Airport, paid a cab to take me to Ardrossan Harbour, and boarded the ferry to Oran. There was a person waiting at the landing for me, my name on his cardboard sign. They were dressed all in black, a veiled hood covering all discernible features of their face. I couldn't even tell the gender. What did I get myself into now? I stepped off the ferry and set my bags down in front of the person holding the sign with my name on it. Here I was, on Scotland's Isle of Oran, waiting to be driven, I supposed, to a castle of some kind. Why was I here? What did this person or people want with me? The hooded figure led me to a vehicle that already had the keys in the ignition. I expected them to get in and open the trunk for me, but that wasn't the case. The figure gestured to the driver's seat, and so I threw my bags in the back and sat behind the wheel. I didn't hear them get in the car, but when I looked, they were in the passenger seat beside me. The drive was beautiful but awkward. I had to keep reminding myself that I was supposed to be on the left side of the road, and the silence was deafening. I tried to make conversation, but the person beside me only nodded forward and gestured with gloved hands which way for me to go. We cut off the road onto a dirt path that led through the Knockin woods, I think. I pulled up to a house. House isn't the right word. The estate, and put the car in park. I stared for a moment, wondering what in the name of God I was doing in a place like this. How did this person know my name? How did he know about my mark, and what did he want with me? As I asked myself these questions, I noticed that my guide was no longer in the car, but gesturing for me to follow him or her inside. How did he keep doing that? I hopped out of the vehicle and grabbed my bags. As I got to the front door, I realized that I was alone again. My guide was nowhere to be found. What the hell? I muttered before lifting the heavy brass door knocker and letting it fall back into place. The resounding knock was louder than I thought it would be. I gave a light press on the door when no one answered and it creaked slowly open. Of course, you're telling at me not to go in. I was too, honestly. I went in. It had only been a week since my ordeal with Dr. Rosen, and I was still rather jumpy, so when a voice echoed through the wide open foyer, I nearly leapt out of my skin. Welcome to my humble home. I dropped my bags and made straight for the door. Of course, it had shut behind me. There, his hand still on the door, was a tall, broad figure. clad entirely in black with the exception of a white and gold Venetian mask that hid every inch of skin on his face. The cheeks on the masks were bunched beneath the squinting eyes, pulling the lips upward into a perpetual grin. I stared, frozen in awe and curiosity at whoever or whatever this was. Logic told me that I should be terrified of this man wearing a creepy mask and dressed completely in black, but something about him seemed familiar. With movements as fluid as a petal dancing on the surface of water, but as commanding a respect as a military officer, he approached me and bowed. "I am Nahum Arasiel, master of this home, and your host for the duration of your stay." Standing directly next to him, I could see just how tall he really was. I felt like a child looking up at his father, minus the extremely creepy mask. Curiosity overwhelmed me. "I don't mean to be rude, sir. Why do you wear that creepy mask?" I immediately regretted asking. He tilted his head ever so slightly, giving the grin a frightening twist. The eyes formed more like a frown. "Wasn't the mask smiling before?" "Why do you?" he answered back in a polite tone that was laced with a subtle hint of spite. "All men wear masks. Mine just happens to be physical." I swear the mask looked angry. Knowing that it was still grinning, the lips seemed to open slightly more and the eyes turned in. It wasn't possible, though, was it? I didn't physically see anything change, but it was enough to keep me from pressing the issue. The rest of my stay, I never again asked him. I won't go into boring detail about the next few hours settling into my stateroom or the outrageous feast that followed. I will caveat with the fact that my host did not eat a bite, nor did he drink a sip. He merely watched with great interest as I consumed the food he had placed in front of me. I will also add that I never once saw servant or cook through the entirety of my stay. After dinner was done and I was settled in, I asked my host as graciously as I could why I had been brought there. I was somewhat suspecting he was going to kill me, maybe even eat me, seeing as how he was fattening me up. "My dear child, you're but a clump of ore pulled from the mountainside. In time, however, though much pain and toil, you will be purified, beaten, folded, and quenched into a weapon of unimaginable strength and power." I shivered at the words that poured from unmoving porcelain lips. Gloved fingers pressed against my forehead, against the invisible mark. "You were chosen for this crucible, to be strengthened in fire of holy purpose, or to be shattered on the anvil of your trials." As quickly as I was able to blink, he stood and from beneath his black Inverness cape produced a long, glimmering blade. The metal seemed to dance and moved almost like mercury, turning the light that reflected off of it at all different colors. The handle was white, possibly alabaster or ivory, wrapped in white, gold, and silver, with a handguard much like that of a rapier, but two-handed. I felt a tinge of fear behind my awe that forced my eyes away from the sword and to the black holes where his eyes hid. "You are destined for greatness, hand-picked by the divine to carry out his work. You bear his seal." As his words revealed my apparent destiny, or leastwise this man's idea of my destiny, his thumb brushed against the mark on my forehead. "You shall discard your old life and everything you once were. Your training begins hence." All of this sounded amazing and completely insane. This kind of thing doesn't happen in real life. This man was insane, clearly. So was I, coming to this place expecting any form of logical explanation. I'm sure I rolled my eyes, stood and turned away from Nahum, heading towards the door. "Thanks for the meal and the hospitality, but..." I was cut off, Nahum standing in front of me, almost as if he had always been there. It was impossible for him to move that fast. I shook it off as another bit of crazy I was experiencing and pushed past him. A black glove closed around my wrist and I felt my feet leave the ground, followed shortly by my face replacing them. I bounded back to my feet and turned toward the mask. "What the f—" A palm connected with my ear. Either that or a bomb went off. For a moment, my senses were blacked out completely, and then I felt pain as a booted foot connected with my sternum and sent me sprawling. "I did not give you permission to stand, child." The porcelain man's voice sounded, reeking of commanding presence. I gasped, barely able to see or hear, but amply able to feel the agony of my crushed ribcage. "If you still choose to leave, then do so." I shuffled my feet beneath me toward the door. A leg swept my own from under me, and a hand pressed against the back of my head. My face connected with the cherry wood floor with a sickening crunch and a disgusting pop. I spent the next 42 days trying my damnedest to get out of that house. Every day, I was given as many chances as I remained conscious for to reach the door. Every morning, I'd wake up to a first aid kit and clean bandages. Of course, anything life-threatening was dealt with while I was knocked out, but I had to set my own nose. I don't know how many times, and had to stitch my own gashes and cuts. I was no longer offered extravagant feasts, but a crust of bread and a cup of water in the morning and at midday. All my earthly possessions were taken and destroyed, but it was made clear that I was not a prisoner. I could leave whenever I had the desire and will to overcome the porcelain man and make it to the door. It took 42 days. I'll never forget the feeling of the sun on my bruised skin and the fresh air in my scarred lungs. I only made it as far as the front steps before Nahum stopped me. The door wasn't my final test, it seemed. There was a circle on the ground with a knife in the center. Pick up the knife and get to the tree line. So I did, or tried. Nahum drew his sword. 38 days and 172 new scars later, I made it to the tree line. And yet, I still wasn't done. Get to the Lamlash Ferry. Easy enough. Only 6 miles. A trek should have only taken 2 hours. Walking. 4 tries it took being hunted, every step of the way from horseback. When I finally arrived, I was met by an elderly Scottish sailor that offered me a box of tea cakes. Nahum told me to watch for an American child. He says you'd to bring him these by tonight. In my ferries until that Moor's night. I blinked at him 4 or 6 times, trying to piece together the words that were English from the words that were Scottish. What are you looking at me like I'm a bam pot? Go on. Holy Island, I got that part. No more ferries? Did he expect me to swim these to him? I sealed the plastic box as best I could before plunging into the water. When I finally made it across, I still had to hike up Mullock Moor. I nearly collapsed when I reached the top and saw him standing there, his sword in hand. I tossed the box at his feet and dropped to my knees, exhausted. You win, I consented. Train me. I'll learn everything you. He thrust his sword at me, and I narrowly evaded, took hold of his wrist and twisted. He flew through the air, rolled effortlessly, and rose gracefully to his feet. And what, pray tell, do you think I've been doing? Already you're stronger, faster, and more agile. You're ready. Retrieving his sword from the dirt, he ushered me to kneel before him. The blade was surprisingly warmed as it touched each of my shoulders in turn. He then ordered me to stand, no longer the man I once was. Even my name had been discarded back at the estate. Draco shall henceforth be your name. Gift of God, Draco, son of the dragon. After that, I trained with him on a regular basis, as well as being sent on various tasks around the island. I was forbidden from going to the mainland, but I was trained to hunt in the woods, learned how to track, and how to survive. He trained me in knowledge as well, thousands of books about mythological, spiritual, and legendary monsters, how to kill them, how to defend against them, how to befriend them. I was trained 2 years and never given answers concerning my mark or who or what saved me from those demons. It was 2 years before I even saw my first monster. I was sent to Norfolk to kill Black Shop.